Comics.
Movies.
Music.
Video games.
Technology.
Blu-ray.
Television.
This is the HHW LOD Podcast Network.
Now recording, and this is Out Now with Aaron and Abe. I am Aaron, and after a break, it is also
Abe. Yo, yo, yo.
Hey, he's back.
I'm back.
You feeling good?
Feeling a lot better, thanks.
You feeling great?
I don't know about great. Feeling pretty good.
I like that vote of confidence. Moving on. Out Now is a film podcast which has Abe and I discussing new movies weekly. We also bring in a little discussion about the latest movie trailers, box office results and predictions, a retro review that has to do with the main film of the week, games and other fun stuff. The main films of the week, this is a twofer, are going to be Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol and Sherlock Holmes A Game of Shadows for this really packed episode, and why not pack it up more with a couple guests. And joining us tonight is writer for Damn Dirty Blog and current owner of his own human centipede, Jordan Grout.
Hello.
And writer for Huffington Post, Mendelsohn's Memos, and box office pundit, Scott Mendelsohn.
How you doing?
Great.
Awesome.
Good to have you guys here. There's a lot to discuss in this today.
So. This is a packed show.
So much.
Yep. And
we just put this up into two movies.
Yeah, so this is episode 39, by the way, for anyone keeping score. And a few announcements. We had a couple bonus shows coming in the coming weeks, which I mentioned previously, but we recorded one just recently, and there should be another one coming soon after that. And they're both in collusion with the WDTV podcast, the Walking Dead TV podcast, which is one of our sister shows on the HHW LOD podcast network. So we're happy to kind of help pitch in for them, and we're looking forward to, you know, having everyone share into the fun of zombie-related bonus episode podcasts. So there's that. Also, iTunes reviews. It is always fun to get ratings and reviews on iTunes, you know, promote awareness and whatnot. It's all good. So feel free to go for that. It's very simple to do. Be awesome. Yep, that's how many that one. And anyway, now moving on, let's go to Know Everybody, where we try to set the tone for the podcast by asking a few questions to each other and kind of get to know everybody. And I'm going to let Abe start this one off this week.
Awesome. I'm a great one for you, Aaron.
Oh, good.
Okay. Who is a better sidekick, Wafflebot or Dr. Watson?
Keep coming at me with the Wafflebot. Let's see. I haven't seen Wafflebot attempt, to resuscitate someone's life. That said, I don't know if he can't do that either.
He probably could.
And he does come with syrup, but he does have playful banter as well, so...
And emotions.
That puts Wafflebot pretty high on the list, but I'm still going to say I like Jude Law's mustache, so I'm going to go with Watson.
Fair enough.
What if Wafflebot had his mustache, though?
Ooh.
Damn.
Like a Chef Boyardee-style mustache.
Exactly.
You guys are killing me, so I'm going to have to wait till Harold and Kumar time travel back to the Victorian age and meet up with Sherlock and Watson, bringing Wafflebot along. And once that happens, I'll have a final decision.
See, that's a fourth film I would be interested in.
All right. Scott.
Yes.
Jeremy Renner, better fit as a spy for the Bourne series or the Mission Impossible series?
Well, keeping in mind, I think the Bourne series should be dead and buried. I thought he was quite good in Mission Impossible. Having said that, I do not want him to replace Tom Cruise anytime soon, but I think he would make a fine supporting character in the franchise. So, Mission Impossible.
All right.
Aaron, let's do a bit of current events. Now that Kim Jong-il is dead, which distinctly non-North Korean actor would you choose to play him in the horribly race-bended biopic that will eventually be made?
let's see. I was going to say Trey Parker was an automatic choice for me right there. Because so Ronery. But, what's a better one? let's just say Ken Jeong. Let's just go for it. Let's just go for Ken Jeong. He's already popped up in Transformers, so he might as well just put him out. I wonder if he has a choice for himself. Like how like Mandela like said Freeman's like the only person that should have played him. I wonder if Kim Jong-il had a person that he would say only should play him.
Denzel Washington.
All right. Jordan. Sherlock and Watson or Batman and Robin? Which is the better duo?
I'm going to go with Sherlock and Watson. I like Batman by himself.
Yeah. All right.
Okay, Abe, I liked your question, so I'm going to kind of steal it.
All right.
What is your favorite robot, Wafflebot or the 80s robot from Muppets?
That is a great question. Unlike Aaron, who chose Wafflebot, I'd have to go with 80s robot because he's so outdated and that he's so funny. He drives a car, and he has 56K dial-up.
I like how this is you're assuming that Wafflebot's apparently, like, he's in the now. That's like your logic in this.
Wafflebot is so mainstream, Aaron. No. But yeah, I like 80s robot. I actually posed that question to Aaron, like, during our Muppets podcast. Jordan, right back at you. This is actually almost piggybacking off of your question, too, which is, what would be a better movie? Tom Cruise and Ving Rhames as Sherlock and Watson, or Robert Downey Jr. and Jude Law as Batman and Robin with British accents?
Good lord. That's success for both of them.
I think so, too.
It's Ving Rhames, Batman, or Robin.
No. Ving Rhames is Sherlock and Watson.
He's both of them?
No. He's in that movie.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to go with that one.
Tom Cruise and Ving Rhames as Sherlock and Watson?
Yeah.
Excellent choice.
I'd be giggling the whole time. Favorite Hans Zimmer score?
This is me?
Yes.
The Lion King.
Ooh, nice choice.
Yeah.
Everybody talks about the songs, fair enough, but it really is a gorgeous, gorgeous actual score.
It really is.
I love the Pride Lands theme. I always have. And I'm not going to start humming it because I'm sure I would butcher it. Yeah, That score and Hunchback of Notre Dame, which I think was Menken, but I'm not sure, are probably my two favorite Disney scores.
Yeah, when I rewatched Lion King when it came out on Blu-ray, because I hadn't watched it in such a long time, I really forgot that Hans Zimmer did the score of that movie. And it's fantastic. Like that's such a great movie overall.
Jordan, yes. What would be franchise that you enjoy do you not want to see a sequel to?
We already said Bourne, so I'm not going to say that again. How about The Crow?
Fair enough. Yes. That's
actually a pretty excellent choice.
Or Scream.
That yes.
Oh, God. Yeah, there's my choice right there. Scream.
Okay. God. I didn't even think of that one.
After they copped out of trying to do something new with 4. Like, yeah. That's a whole other discussion. Point to note, the music in Hunchback of Notre Dame was Alan Menken.
Yes. I would have known that for sure when I was in high school, but now not so much. I'm an old man.
All right, so moving on. That was No, Everybody. And now we're going to move into some trailer talk. And rather than discuss a couple trailers like we tend to do every week, we're just going to talk about the Dark Knight Rises prologue, which, of course, was the big much ado over the course of the weekend, since it played exclusively with certain prints of Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol in IMAX. And I guess just to set it up, the first 6 minutes or 6 minutes of the Dark Knight Rises were shown in glorious giant IMAX framing, and this is basically the introduction of Bane as a character, much like how the Joker was introduced in The Dark Knight when that film came out in 2008.
And, yes.
And, I know we all have thoughts on this, so I'm going to – I'll just go how we went. I'll start with Abe again. Abe, what did you think of the Dark Knight Rises prologue?
Compared to the bank heist, I didn't see the bank heist in 2008, but compared to the bank heist, I think the bank heist was way more, like, gritty in your face. This trailer did want me to see more of the movie, of course, and I think one of the best things about it is – I really like how Bane is a little bit more of like a conniving, you know, upfront character instead of like a Mountain Dew, like, you know, overzealous character, just, you know, chalked up on Mountain Dew. But I wasn't really super like involved. Maybe that's the way that they wanted it, because I'm glad they didn't reveal anything about the Batman or any of the storylines or what have you. But yeah, I mean, it was okay, not the greatest. I like the use of the wide shots for the plane flying and stuff like that. But I wasn't like overly impressed with it. But again, I did like that. I wanted to see more, and that's probably just because I'm really excited for this movie in general.
I actually like the montage at the end more than the actual 6 minutes. That was far more exciting for me, seeing all the like clips like Catwoman and like the streets, like the Gangs of New York type battle that was going on. And but the clip, you know, like I said, it's okay. It's definitely not as effective as the Joker. I like how Bane doesn't have like this deep voice. I enjoyed it for what it was.
All right, before I get to Scott, I just want to say, you mentioned Gangs of New York, which now makes me think that Daniel Day-Lewis should play the Mad Hatter at some point in the series. Scott, your thoughts on the prologue?
I didn't like it at all. Keeping in mind, I was not the biggest fan of the bank robbery prologue when I saw it as a standalone piece. I thought it was, you know, gorgeous to look at, but I thought, hey, it's just a bank robbery. That's nice. It works better in the context of the film as just the first 6 minutes that sets up, you know, a new threat and somewhat subtly sets up, you know, the organized crime scene in Gotham. Having said that, as a standalone action sequence for this film, I thought the new prologue was kind of terrible. I had difficulty telling what was going on in the interior action beats. It was edited within an inch of its life. Nolan does have that problem sometimes. He gets very all green grassy. I'm watching this on a, you know, 100-foot screen, and I'm having trouble telling what's going on. It had another example of something that I thought was slightly a problem in The Dark Knight, where he's so afraid of getting an R rating that he cuts the violence so obtusely that you really can't see what's going on. I mean, you cut to a guy with a machine gun shooting, and I have no idea who was hit. You know, the primary character other than Bane was a CIA agent played by, I might mispronounce his name, Aidan Gillian. First of all, he was terrible in it. He did get the worst of the dialogue, but I'll get to that in a second. I don't know what happened to him. He doesn't have a final scene. Obviously, the plane crashes, he dies, so be it. But he did, you know, the film was so chaotically edited that I don't, you know, there was no last, you know, acknowledgement of what happened to that character.
Right.
And as far as the dialogue, it was very on the nose. It felt like a bad kids cartoon, you know, who is Bane? Why does he wear that mask? If he take off that mask, will you die? Who cares? This crazy terrorist character that you know about because you mentioned him has infiltrated your plane, and you ask him questions as opposed to trying to kill him. All we need to know is there's a guy with a scary mask and he's going to kill a bunch of CIA agents and crash a plane. That's all we need to know. But the other problem is, and I'm not going to be the first person to say this, Bane's dialogue was very difficult to understand.
Yeah.
And he offers a lot of exposition in that sequence. So you have choppily edited action, very cheesy dialogue by the characters that we can understand, and plot exposition offered by a character that we can't understand. And when he did talk, when we can't understand what he said, it's one thing to not have a very deep, brooding voice. That's fine. He sounded like Mr. Freeze in Batman and Robin. I'm sorry. I was thinking I used to see you. he's very peppy and cheerful, and you know, the fire rises. That doesn't strike fear into my heart. And I have seen the regular trailer. I know not everybody has. He does have a line of at least one line of dialogue there where he sounds more like a conventional villain, so it might have just been an ADR issue. But as an advertisement for the film, not only does it not make work as, you know, as a standalone piece, it honestly makes me worried the film won't be good because it's so incompetent in so many basic ways.
Okay. I'm of two minds about the prologue. It comes down to this is on the biggest screen possible, and basically watching things in IMAX, I could watch you know, just somebody reading a newspaper in this frame and be like, oh, this is awesome because of how large in scope it is and I can see everything. But on the other hand, yeah, there's a big problem of context. I think that's the main thing that affected my enjoyment of the prologue overall. Like, because opposed to Dark Knight with that prologue, which was with I Am Legend when that came out.
Yes.
Watching that, like, even though, like, you want to see more of the film and there's just, you know, there's only so much of it. I think it did a good job of just setting up the Joker character, and I think it did so without having you need to know what else is going on in this movie. There you got a bank robbery scene that's pretty standalone. It's a bank robbery, like you said, but I mean, you don't need more to it than that. In this prologue with Bane, you have this mystery of who this Bane character is. You have all this stuff going on. He's in a plane. There's something about blood transfusion going on or something at some point. It was like that. That's how confusing it seemed to be in terms of the interior action that's going on in the plane once that all happens. And it honestly was just, it was too much of, there seems to be a lot of fill in the blanks that I can't fill in yet because I don't know what else is going on in this movie, as opposed to Dark Knight, where it's just like, oh, there's a bank robbery, Joker's here, and he's a certain type of character because he has all these wild things going on in his plan. Meanwhile, you have Bane, who seems to be a force to be reckoned with, and I think that's for sure proven in terms of just the physicality that he seems to possess. It's clear that Tom Hardy's like, he's huge in this role. Like, that's kind of, I was kind of impressed at how big he was. No, having seen him in Bronson and having seen him in Warrior, I guess too. But like this man seems to, much like I guess Christian Bale can, he knows how to go up and down and wait. So overall, no, I wasn't a huge fan of it. And yes, I've seen the trailer now, and even in the format that I've seen it in, it still got me kind of rising up to be like, yeah, I want to see Dark Knight right now, and now I have to wait. So I'm sad. Prologue didn't quite do for now. I do have something to say about the acting, for that matter. In not necessarily acting, but the way dialogue's presented. I think it's very similar to the way The Dark Knight bank robbery sequence dialogue is presented, where it's very comic booky and very kind of one line exposition kind of. And I think it's done so on purpose almost. I can't say that it makes it better because of this, but it kind of, to me, it felt like, yeah, to establish a character, it's kind of a surreal tone where it kind of represents a comic book, which Batman is a part of a comic, and that the same sense that they did in the Dark Knight with the Joker, where you have literally characters wearing masks saying, "Was this part of the plan? No, some guy named the Joker did it." Like, it just has all this.
And that annoyed me 4 years ago, but whatever.
Yeah, it kind of evoked the same thing to me in regards to that. Mm-hmm. So that's something that didn't seem like an issue to me as much. Okay, any other thoughts on the Dark Knight Rises prologue?
Pretty much covered.
Anything
on my end?
Any thoughts on the actual trailer? Just like some brief thoughts, maybe.
In what regard?
I don't know. Anything that is like, oh, I didn't know this was happening. Or
I like the scene of Selina Kyle and Bruce Wayne dancing. It reminds me of Batman Returns, and
yes,
I love Batman Returns. So that was definitely a positive for me.
Wasn't a big fan of the mirror shot, though, with the Catwoman's whole entire getup on. I was like, maybe. I like the Selina Kyle Batman Returns, you know, leather and stitches.
I thought it certainly was a better piece of marketing than the prologue. Mm-hmm. It certainly can't compare to the first Dark Knight trailer. I mean, that, dear God. I remember watching the cruddy bootleg 4 years ago this weekend and not knowing that there was going to be a conventional trailer. And, you know, I wrote about this last year, but it just made me feel 12 years old again. And now I find 4 years later that I'm nostalgic for my own nostalgia.
In the year of nostalgia.
Exactly.
Oh.
More or less, let's be honest. There's a reason the artist is, well, I'm not going to say, I know you liked it more than I did, but whatever. Sorry, back to Batman. It's a good trailer in that what I like about it is that it looks, you know, this is the strength of the series. It looks so much unlike any other comic book franchise being made. It feels like a real movie in a real universe with real stakes and a certain heightened intensity that doesn't necessarily feel like what you think of a Batman trailer.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And whatever issues I have about, you know, I'm, you know, whatever issues I might have about it is still a pretty decent trailer that I perhaps hold to an unfair standard because of just how friggin' awesome the first Dark Knight trailer was 4 years ago. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And I miss the theme music. It shows up right at the end. And that's goosebumps. In a weird way, my favorite. Yeah, you get goosebumps, but you need that music in the trailer. That's the fun of seeing trailers to sequels, is you get goosebumps hearing the familiar music in the context of new footage.
I like how over the years, because when Batman Begins came out, like I was a fan of the movie because I love everything Batman, but yeah. We don't talk about Batman, Robin, but
I could kind of defend it.
But it was another... Actually, I think I tried to kind of defend it in your voice the other week, actually, when Batman came up, just because you made some good points about what the actual story is versus what the movie was. But exactly. When Batman Begins came out and it didn't have the Danny Elfman theme, which was obvious because it's a reboot, so it was a new, it's a fresh start to the thing. It's kind of like, well, the theme's not very memorable compared to Danny Elfman's his Batman theme, which is of course then used in the Batman animated series. But
yes.
when Dark Knight came out, something about the, maybe just because that movie, as we've said, is just freaking awesome. Like it's just that the music it's great from Hans Zimmer and James Newton Howard. Like it's just a fantastic score, and it's just it just sends chills down the spine.
The only problem with it is it's not very easy to hum.
That's the best I can do. It's the same, like Inception isn't easy to hum, yet everyone seems to just know exactly what to key into when you think of Inception's music. Yep, exactly. The Vuvuzela. Yeah. Hell. All right, let's move on now, finally, to our first movie review for Mission Impossible: Ghost Protocol.
What was that?
Abort.
Ethan, what happened in the Kremlin?
It was a setup.
The Russians are classifying this as an undeclared act of war. The blame points to you and your team. The president has initiated Ghost Protocol. The entire IMF has been disavowed.
So what happens now?
Your mission, should you choose to accept it.
The secretary is dead. The four of us are all that remains of the IMF. No safe house, no support or extraction. Everyone connected with this man is an asset with valuable information. We come back with our target. But we don't come back.
And how do you propose that we do that?
We take him out.
Yeah, we take him out. But, discreetly.
Discreetly.
All right, so that was a little bit of the trailer for Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, the live-action feature film debut of director Brad Bird of Incredibles fame, among other things. And, this newest entry in the Mission Impossible franchise finds Tom Cruise's Ethan Hunt once again on another seemingly impossible mission, as he and his team, played by Paula Patton, Simon Pegg, and new analyst Jeremy Renner, team up to, well, they all get, basically IMF gets framed for destroying the Kremlin, and which activates Ghost Protocol, which means that the government has basically disavowed all of IMF, and they need to figure out what's went wrong, which is, of course, the product of a terrorist codenamed Cobalt, who has some Russian nuke codes, it seems, and there's just a lot of spy stuff happening, and they need to stop nukes from going off. That's pretty much the plot right there. So let's get right into it, because we got a lot of things to talk about. So, start with Abe once again. What did you think of Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol?
Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol is a solid, solid movie. I particularly enjoyed all the gadgets that they employed, especially like the contact lenses, the printer case, and the hallway screen. I think that the characters were on par with the other films. There were some cheesy lines, but I mean, for the most part, I think what this film really did well was it centered around that these guys are spies, and they're doing spy things, and they don't really get away from it with, like, love story here and love story there, or side missions here and side missions there. It's really about finding Cobalt and trying to stop him from destroying, starting World War III. I think that it was kind of cheesy in terms of the Russians being kind of really Russian, I think. I don't know how that would be taken to others, but it's just, they seemed a little bit like, movie-style Russian, where they just like drinking potato vodka. But I think the other thing that I didn't like as much was I kind of wanted maybe some more development of Cobalt as what his motives may have been and things of that nature. But for the most part, well choreographed action sequences, big fan of Jeremy Renner, and you know, him doing his stuff in this film. And again, great shots in Dubai. It was just a solid film. I really liked it a lot as a spy film and as a standalone film in the franchise. Probably I did enjoy the John Woo one, so probably like up there in terms of like either one or two of the Mission Impossible franchise.
I loved it. I think it's the best one since the first one. I still haven't made up my mind if I like if it's better than the first one, but I'm definitely gonna see it again. I felt the humor worked perfectly, but which is always kind of a fine line, but I think it works splendidly with this one. The camera work was superb. I'll say more later on. Move on.
First of all, I very, very, very much enjoyed this picture. It may or may not be my favorite of the series behind the first one, although they're such different films, it's almost unfair to compare them. It's apples to oranges.
Yeah.
I too actually enjoyed the second film.
Mm-hmm.
We might be the only ones on Earth that still admit that. I mean, all four of us.
Oh.
it was that kind of just big screen sheer showmanship that you just don't see anymore, even in would be, you know, big scale entertainments. The stunts were fantastic, and they were engaging on a, I don't want to say an emotional level. It's not like you were cringing or crying or anything, but because there was so much emphasis of how difficult this stuff was and, you know, how scared these characters were to be doing it, it added that level of excitement and I don't want to say comedy, but it was funny watching Tom Cruise hold his breath before he jumped out the window. Or, you know, and certainly Jeremy Renner's his bit with his big third act moment.
Yeah.
That works. Yes. And it's very funny. It makes him very engaging to an audience. I did have a few problems with it. Mainly, I felt that Paula Patton was sort of, she was sort of encumbered, is that the right word? Encumbered with a needless, you know, crisis and conscience backstory that sort of came into the second and third act. And she was borderline incompetent for much of the second and third act. You know, the unfortunately, a lot of the movie went on as it did because she screwed up, basically, for lack of a better term. I felt that there's a scene in the third act where she has to do...
She has to use her sex appeal.
Yeah, she has to use her feminine wiles. And on one hand, I'm kind of glad that they actually presented a fairly attractive female character as not being good at that kind of thing. Because that's different. You know, she may look like Paula Patton, but she can't just seduce anyone with the drop of a hat because, you know. On the other hand, frankly, I found the you know, I don't know his name. He's the guy from Slumdog Millionaire in 24. Thank you. It was almost racially discomforting how, you know, it was sort of the sleazy foreigner that was sort of off-putting. It towed a line there. I also felt that the film, you know, it was almost a procedural. You know, this is how they do the job. This is them planning the job. This is them doing the job. And while I liked that there was, as you guys said, a lack of side garbage, there was no romantic interest. There was no, you know, what have you. It also, there really was no real, I don't want to say point because that's too strong. But let me just say, the first film was about Ethan Hunt. He's young, he's naive. He discovers the dark side of espionage. The second film was Ethan Hunt dealing with arguably, you know, the evil Ethan Hunt. You know, his evil doppelganger. The third film, of course, which I don't like as much as other people do, but it at least tried to tell an interesting story of Ethan Hunt's professional life, you know, making an absolute mess of his personal life. This film really didn't have any, you know, underlying theme or reason to it. You know, it was just another episode of a weekly show. Of a weekly show. And that's okay because it was a very, 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 very good episode. But if I had to pick out one big flaw, it was that it really didn't have a lot of substance to its spectacle. But God, the spectacle was fantastic. From beginning to end, it was creative. It was well acted. It was well performed. It looked real. I'm going to assume it was all practical because it looked all practical. And it was edited in a way that you could actually tell what was going on, unlike certain six-minute prologues that preceded the film. And the IMAX footage was beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I think in a way, it certainly, you know, obviously it's the first film to do this since Transformers, and it had a lot more IMAX footage than Transformers 2 did. But it once again shows that, you know, IMAX is the future of, you know, big, major franchise filmmaking. 3D was a distraction, but IMAX is where it's going to be. And it just, in terms of sheer showmanship, it's one of the best big scale action films I've seen in several years.
Well, yeah, that's all of this you guys have said is what I agree with as well. This movie, I'm just going to, because you guys have made out the big points already, I'm just going to jump straight to something that is ridiculous. Tom Cruise is hanging outside the tallest building in the world because he's Tom Cruise, and he's like, I'm going to do this because I want this movie to be amazing. And he's done so because that scene is amazing. Watching him in Dubai hanging outside that giant tower, and I'll put a link in the show notes to, like, footage of him and most likely one of a stunt double, but he does so many of his own stunts, it's ridiculous. But just him... And the way that scene said it, like, everyone knows in the trailer that he's going to be hanging outside this building at some point and doing something that's impossible on a mission. But watching...
Doing something impossible on a mission. Nice.
watching how that scene set up, how it plays, how the IMAX cameras are used to capture the sheer sense of height and tension involved in what he's doing, and how it's all framed and how it all comes together, and how it's fun. Like, you're on the edge of your seat and you're also having a blast watching it. It's ridiculous that this scene exists, but it happened because Tom Cruise is, like, he's a producer and he said, I want to make an amazing Mission Impossible action scene. And just watching this centerpiece sequence of the film is just absolutely fantastic. Now, with that said, yes, we've all seen this in IMAX because we talked about the prologue, which is the only place you can see it, and the giant real IMAXs. And how Brad Bird manages to, like, use all of those sequences is fantastic. Like, there's about 30 minutes of footage shot in IMAX cameras, and it looks marvelous. Like, this is a movie that you go to see on that screen. Like, just like Hugo is a movie you go and see in 3D, Mission Impossible is a movie you go and see in IMAX. It's completely worth it. Now, with that said, even if you don't see it in IMAX, just see this movie because it's just a hell of a lot of fun. It's just a great action movie to watch. Like, it's very straightforward. That's the main issue I have as well. It doesn't have the same twists and turns that kind of Mission Impossible 1 kind of had, where there's a sense of unexpected coming on. There are turns in the story because, I mean, it's not a completely predictable movie, but, I mean, it doesn't have that same kind of mysterious allure that, like, a real twisty espionage thriller would have. It's more of a straight up action movie that happens to feature a lot of spies in it. But I did appreciate a lot of the ties to the TV series as well. Of course, it's not like the TV show because that's a hour long show from the 60s opposed to a big blockbuster Tom Cruise spectacle. But it had a lot of the teamwork, which was something that made the first one and the third one to an extent kind of very, very welcome. It involved every character. It made use of their specialties, even though they're not, like, really well-defined characters, but it made good use of everybody, so you always had a sense of who everyone was, what they're doing, and how they're affecting the action going on. And it had a lot of, like Abe said, it had a lot of really cool gadgets. Mm-hmm. It had just all these cool things that make a Mission Impossible movie worthwhile. And, yeah, it all came together to make a great, great action movie that's plenty accessible because there's no real ties to the... Beyond some character details, there's no real ties to the other entries that you really need to know to, like, go into this movie and see. But it all works out really, really well. It's just a lot of fun. Yeah.
To piggyback on what Scott said, I mean, one of the things that I what he said is true is I didn't really pick up on was everything looks not green screened. So yeah. it's very practical looking, and I didn't really pick up on that. But now that I'm thinking back on it, yeah, you really don't get the sense that anything was computer generated, or they did it with, you know, maybe some of the sandstorm stuff.
The sandstorm stuff, yeah. But even then, you're not even really thinking about it.
Yeah, I was like, he's got to go get that guy. But yeah, it was very well done. I mean, I really enjoyed, how good this movie was. I mean, I think one of the other things I really wasn't too keen on was, like, why is Ving Rhames in this movie? So. I mean, just maybe for added familiar effects, but that was probably it.
There's a lot of error in things. There's a lot of things that went wrong for the team, which was kind of like enjoyable in a way because it made things all the more tense, but also kind of there was a lightheartedness to the spy activities in the wake of, you know, nuclear disasters going on, and I kind of admired a lot of that, especially in the form of Simon Pegg, he made this movie like a blast to watch. Like it was great to see him like in shape again. After watching Paul, where he's really paunchy in the movie, I was like, oh, Simon Shape's like, he's like, Simon Pegg, like, he did a little workout apparently to be on the IMF team. I appreciated
that. The field agent again.
Yeah, but he was a lot of fun. Jeremy Renner, I like Jeremy Renner a lot in this movie, actually, because he wasn't playing kind of like the rebellious, like, I'm going to do it my way kind of thing. He was actually he had a lot of fun bouncing off the rest of the team.
He was close to being a dick when he had the briefcase.
He was,
when he had the briefcase, figures it out, yeah.
Or when he had to embark upon his soliloquy of, I have things from the past I need to tell you, but I can't.
You should have sang.
He's probably
here musical. Is my secret.
Here's a question, just a random one. If this movie came out in the mid 90s, would Halle Berry have played the Paula Patton part?
I hope not.
Yeah, I hope not either.
No way.
Yeah.
I will say that, you know, kudos to the Mission Impossible franchise. You have four films, two of which have African American female leads, and at no point does anyone comment on the color of their skin.
Ooh, good point.
Mm-hmm. That's, you know, 2 for 4 is unprecedented. Something you guys mentioned about, you know, Tom Cruise, what I loved about this movie is, to a certain extent, it was sort of his get off my lawn moment. You know, it's the sheer just, you know, I'm going to, you know, you may think I'm crazy in real life, but I'm going to make the best gosh darn action picture you've ever seen, and you will love me again because you will be so entertained, and I don't care if I die of a heart attack from all this running. You will love me again because I make better movies than they do. So, you know, go buzz off.
I was happy to see that. Something occurred to me when I was rewatching the original Mission Impossible movies, or the first ones, and he has short hair in the first and third, and long hair in the second and fourth one.
Yes.
And I was kind of thinking, I hope it wasn't a Star Trek situation where every other one's like really good. Didn't happen this time around. I was happy to see the long hair work and not have too much crazy John Woo action, which I do like that movie, but not in the same way as the others.
I love that the character also of Ethan Hunt wasn't invincible. Like, he really got hurt.
Like, I like seeing everyone hesitate in this movie. There
was, yes, that's what it was, the hesitation. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And like, there were some visceral punches he took, like whether it's like throwing the car off the dock or jumping through the window, like, oh man.
Never made it easy, yeah. Like, there's an escape sequence where he has to kind of get out of a situation where he's already been injured, and he really has to hesitate before he, like, kind of makes a decision of how to go about a scene.
Yeah.
He gets beat up in this movie, I'll just put it that way, and that's not overlooked.
Yeah, I agree, yeah. I mean, when he's, like, trying to hobble away, that's the thing, you know, all the details, yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things I liked is that they, you know, he's implicated for the bombing, and he has a Russian agent after him, and they don't make that guy the bad guy. You almost, you know, you're not rooting for him so much, but you don't want him to be humiliated at the end.
Yeah.
It's a nice little touch that I appreciated. As far as the action, you're right. I liked that it was, you know, real fist fights and real chases. And, you know, this is pure speculation, but I honestly think, you know, we're getting toward the end of the fantasy dominating everything. You know, we're running out of comic books to adapt. You know, the teen, kid, young adult fantasy literature genre basically, you know, opened and died with Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings, with the exception of Twilight and Narnia. You know,
possibly the Hunger Games. We'll see.
We'll see. You're right. The Hunger Games as well. But even that's somewhat more realistic. I mean, that's basically, you know, Battle Royale for kids.
Yeah.
And I think this film, and to a certain extent Fast Five, which I also enjoyed quite a bit, was sort of a return to, you know, real action, where you can see the sweat and the blood and the tears and the sand with, you know, actual fist fights and actual chases. And I think if this film is as big of a hit as I think it's going to be, especially after this weekend, you know, it could, I don't want to say a game changer, because that's, you know, a bit overblowing it, but I think it could be a stepping stone in a return to where the big films are practical, earthbound action pictures again.
So you're saying Expendables 2 is going to be great, right?
If it's great, then I don't know. Maybe that was a warning shot. But no, I have a cockamamie theory, and I don't want to digress too much, that every 12 years there's a shift in the kind of blockbuster movies we see. 77 brought Star Wars, 89 brought Batman, 2001 brought Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings, and something's going to happen in 2013. And I'm kind of, you know, I think it's going to be sort of a return to, you know, sort of human versus human on Earth action pictures, but, you know, costing a gajillion dollars. But I will stop now because we have a limited amount of time.
Matrix 4 will be crazy.
just set in the desert.
I really enjoyed the the opening title sequence in this film.
Yeah, and agreed. You can totally tell it's Brad Bird.
Yeah, for sure. And you had the Giacchino score doing the original Mission Impossible theme, and mixed with kind of the. It had an opening title sequence, which was really cool, where you have, like, and it did it the same way, like, the first Mission Impossible, even the series, where it kind of shows, it kind of sets you up for what's going to happen throughout this movie, where it kind of shows you, like, kind of glimpses of things, and how that ties into, like, having that theme and having a fuse being lit, I just thought was really, really cool, and it was all IMAX and stuff, and I was like, yeah, this is a lot of, the whole cold open of the movie was actually really cool. I really dug the, how Tom Cruise kind of, how he sets himself up as a character in this movie, and even the opening scene where Sawyer's from Lost is in this movie. I didn't even know that, but he's like Josh Holloway is in this movie, and it's like, oh, that's cool. Even as his own little spy gadget, that was like pretty kick ass. So I was like really happy with the whole opening of the movie. Just set me up, and it just kept me happy throughout the remaining runtime, because it's just such a fun movie to watch.
My only problem with the title sequence. And I felt the same way about the first Mission Impossible because it did the same thing. As I'm thinking, okay, you know, basically I was worried that it was going to spoil me. That the images they were going to choose, even if they weren't intending to be spoilers, that by insinuation, like, oh, okay, a sequence like that's going to be in there. Ergo, I know they're doing this, this, and this. But to my surprise, I completely forgot that sequence even existed 10 minutes into the film.
That's where I was on that. Because when I was watching it, I was like, oh, because I just watched the first Mission Impossible, and I was like, wow, this reveals a lot of key elements were to have seen this movie already. But watching Ghost Protocol, it's fun saying Ghost Protocol, by the way. I haven't harked upon how much it sounds like a Tom Clancy novel, Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. But watching the opening title sequence, I was kind of like, oh, this is like the first again, so I hope it doesn't spoil things. But I'm like, well, this is actually just really cool, just kind of seeing glimpses of things. And I didn't really remember much of what kind of where the scenes went when the actual movie was playing versus what was laid out in the opening title. So yeah, just a quality way to set up the film.
What did you guys think of Cobalt?
I was about to get to that. Yeah. Michael Nyquist.
Who?
Michael Nyquist, who was in the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the Swedish versions, those films. He stars as the villain in this film. And yeah, I think Abe, I think you brought this up. You didn't really know his motivations.
Yeah, he didn't really get too much. You got to know him too much, and he didn't really develop as a character. But
yeah, I would say he's pretty much a stock. He's a stock villain. He doesn't do much. It's very. It's almost like it almost plays to kind of. Of course, it's the Russians. Like, it doesn't really care. It doesn't really care that what this villain is. It's just he has nuke codes. Stop him. Like that's. And, like, I guess it was nice to see, like, oh, this is, it's him from Dragon Tattoo, and he's coming to be in big Tom Cruise blockbuster. That's kind of neat. But, yeah, he didn't really have much to do beyond look intimidating, which I think he did look pretty intimidating. And, he held his own in the scenes that required him to. But, yeah, it didn't really require the most acting.
I did think it was funny that Jeremy Renner, I guess his character, pretty much knew every face on Earth. There's like two or three scenes. Like there's a scene where he spots somebody on a surveillance camera and instantly knows who that is.
He's an analyst. Job.
Jack Ryan would be impressed.
And then there's of course the pivotal scene where Tom Cruise uses his artistic abilities to communicate.
Yes, which is a wonderful, absurd but great moment. And again, it's like, oh, I recognize that thing that you just drew. I know exactly who that is. Here's his address and social security number.
It's like, it's crude, but if I had to guess, I would say that's a terrorist.
Well, it's either the terrorist guy or a diplomat. I'm not sure which one. Let's rough him up anyway, just to be sure.
Did anyone else kind of notice or kind of note that there was kind of almost not very self-referential, but there's kind of acknowledgement of how impossible this movie was. Like, they kind of had a, not necessarily tongue-in-cheek, but it seemed very lighthearted. It didn't seem to, it didn't take itself seriously necessarily.
It was easily the lightest of the four films.
Yes.
And with the exception of a somewhat tossed away subplot involving, you know, an innocent bystander and his family being murdered, there really wasn't much hard violence.
Step above The Incredibles.
Yeah.
And even the Kremlin gets bombed, and I was sort of listening for a body count, and they basically say a bunch of people are injured. They don't say anybody was killed, which I find hard to believe, but whatever. Maybe when I watch it again, I'll have the subtitles on, so I'll be catching for stuff like that. So it was a very light movie, which is why I think Simon Pegg worked better this time around than the third film, which was a much darker picture. Right. You basically had Philip Seymour Hoffman threatening to rape and murder Tom Cruise's wife, and then you have Simon Pegg going, "Ha ha, I'm being funny, like on Alias." but this time around, because it was a lighter film, it didn't feel as out of place.
Yeah, and I think that Jordan put it really well, which is the jokes are placed pretty well. You know, they're pretty well paced, and they're not overly, "Ha ha, that's really funny." It's just more of like, "Oh yeah, good joke." Yeah.
There's, because I can't spoil this at all, but there's a moment at the end which is absolutely amazing in terms of the line that's delivered, and then the fact that it's called back upon like minutes later.
You know, the moments like that are just so indicative of the film's sheer entertainment value. You know, moments that have you cheering on the inside that so many big franchise directors just either don't know how to do or don't bother to do. I mean, I like Thor. But is there really any moment in Thor that just has you, you know, wanting to stand up and applaud? I think Peter Jackson really is one of the only people that knows how to do this. You know, that's one of the reasons the Lord of the Rings films work so well, is they have moments of just, I know I keep coming back to this, showmanship. It's like, not only is it a great scene, but it's delivered so well that it's just wonderful. It's, you know, why you go to these kind of movies.
I would credit that to Brad Bird. Really.
Yeah,
he really is a master of the craft, and he knows how to, you know, reel in the audience, and he knows when to let them go. I mean, but the people I saw with, everyone was on the edge of their seat, and when he's on the building, and he has that little joke with Jeremy Renner, he's like, "No,
yeah."
The audience kind of like let out this sigh of relief. They're like, "Oh, ha 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 ha." And then they're back again, just holding their breath. And it's perfect. It's such just an amazing film in terms of spectacle.
I think Brad Bird did a fantastic job here. And I'm looking forward to seeing the next movies that he does. Because I know he's been wanting to make like his 1901 Earthquake movie. Like that's like something like a passion project, basically, that he wants to make. And I know like basically he took Mission Impossible seemingly just to have, you know, a movie under his belt. To kind of show that he can, you know, he can do something like this. And clearly he's proven he can, because, man, this movie was fantastic to watch. So I'm looking forward to seeing what he does in his future career as both a live-action director and possibly, you know, I'd hope his return to animated features as well. I mean, he has Incredibles, Iron Giant, and Ratatouille under his belt, and that's nothing. Those are great movies on their own right there. So I'm looking forward to seeing what he does in the future. Now, it also makes me curious about what Andrew Stanton will be able to achieve with John Carter, because so far... It hasn't been the. It's not the movie that you're like, "Man, I can't wait to see this right now." Right. I'm still intrigued by it, but the trailers haven't like proven me to be like, and even the footage that I got to see, like, it just hasn't proven me to be like, "Man, this is gonna be something super special." Right. Like, so I'm hoping that not just Brad Bird's the only person that emerges from Pixar as a live action director who can really pull something off.
Mm-hmm. Agreed, yeah, and I had hopes for the second trailer, the second full-length trailer for John Carter, but I was like, still uncertain, on the fence.
Yeah, it's very underwhelming.
Like, that looks like it costs $300, not $300 million.
And so there's another thing about Mission Impossible. The money looks like it's on the screen.
Oh, my God. I don't know the budget, but if you would tell me $400, I would say, okay, worth it.
Yeah,
I mean, it's not 400 for the record.
Yeah, there are some crazy set pieces in this movie.
Like, yeah, some awesome looking cars too.
Yeah, like what did that BMW he had, whatever that thing was.
Yeah.
It's like a Bond car. I guess they're spies, so it makes sense. But still, all right. So let's move on because we still have to talk about Sherlock. So let's and box office. Oh my God, there's so many to talk about. So let's do our rating. Every week we try to rate the films that we review, but not with a letter or a number. We kind of say one, you should go and see this movie, and I think our choices are probably pretty clear. So yeah, let's go with that. Let's go with that right now. I'm gonna count to three, and we'll just say where you should see this movie. 1, 2, 3. IMAX.
IMAX.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then again on Blu-ray.
Yeah, there you go.
On a 100-foot screen.
The biggest IMAX possible. That's where you should go and see this movie.
You can watch it on your iPhone. You know, it's fine.
Yeah, but cool.
Yeah, get the ultraviolet, watch it on Flixster on your droid.
Watch the camera bootleg. It's no big deal.
The prologue and then seep into Mission Impossible. definitely go and see Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol on the biggest IMAX screen possible. And don't just go to see Dark Knight Rises. We've already kind of expressed our opinions on that. But even if like you're just like, yeah, I need to see Batman. This movie is completely worth it on its own. Like, this movie did not need Dark Knight Rises prologue to, like, sell it. It's its own thing.
And it's not doing as well as it's doing for box office because of the Dark Knight prologue.
Yeah.
I'll get to that in a second, but...
Yeah. Now, let's do a quick retro review for Mission Impossible, just so we can do that really quick. So, any movies you guys thought of while in relation to Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, start with Abe.
I mean, obviously, just like the Mission Impossible stuff, but yeah, definitely like The Incredibles, mostly because that opening sequence with Sawyer, that was pretty incredible-ish.
Mission Incredible. Jordan?
The Incredibles. It's like a live-action Incredibles.
Scott?
Honestly, I was reminded in a good way of the things I liked in all three previous Mission Impossible movies. You have the wild, outrageous, somewhat big-screen, epic action of the second film. You have the sheer manic intensity of Tom Cruise from the third film. You know, so much running.
Oh, my God, he's running. I just watching that movie again. I hadn't watched it in a while. He is running throughout that movie. Like, he must, like, log 5 miles within this film.
And, you know, to a certain extent, the we've been framed plot of the first film.
Yeah.
It's funny in the trailer that you played, you know, what happened in the Kremlin? I want to say the same thing that happened in Prague. Where is Henry Czerny? We need to talk to him again. And why the heck haven't they brought him back for just something? He was so much fun the first film.
He plays a lot. Like he's in was he in Patriot Games?
Clear and Presentator. Yes.
Yeah. He plays that kind of that commanding guy.
After those two movies, I thought he was going to be huge, but then he just disappeared.
He was even in the A Team last year too. He popped up as like the same basic role
as a red herring. Because I saw him like, oh, bad guy. he needed the work.
I thought of Salt, actually, from last year with Angelina Jolie, because it had a they're different films, but they had a – no, I know the exact reason why. I was like, why didn't I think of Salt? It's because the stakes of the film, they were kind of ludicrously high in the very classic Bond sense, which I kind of appreciated, where, like, there's nukes. That's the goal. It's just so outlandish. It's like, we have to stop nukes from happening. And I appreciated going – I'd rather see that than another, like – something like just kind of minuscule and not really noteworthy. Like I need a certain amount of money for based on principles or something like that. I just like the over the top. I'm nuking the country because why not?
Yeah.
I'm evil. I'm a terrorist.
Literally, that's his reason.
Well, actually, you're right. It reminded me of the Roger Moore, Sean Connery, James Bond films, both in that it was a very standalone picture without a lot of continuity, and it did the classic. And Ernest Trevano Blofeld should have patented in the 1960s that we're going to make the world kill each other by doing one thing to blame this country and then another thing to blame that country. And then they're going to go to war and then everyone's going to die. And then I'm going to rule whatever's left because it never works. But they've been doing it for 40 years.
Yeah, someone should be getting paid for these ideas.
Yes.
I also had a lot of Modern Warfare 3 coming in on this film, just based on like the giant set pieces and their sandstorm. Anyone that played Modern Warfare 3 and watches Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol will be like, there's a lot of similar scenes here. Anyway, let's move on to, well, what are we doing? Oh, we're gonna have a break because we've been talking for quite a while. So I'm literally just gonna let us go for a second, and I'll just play some random music, maybe something that has the word sandstorm in the title. Yeah, I went there.
I Adjectives on the typewriter. He moves his words like a prize fighter. The frenzied pace of the mind inside the cell. The man on the street might just as well be. The man on the street might just as well. The man on the street might just as well be. Tight jaw, say it all, say it all. But the white paint, plastic saints, say it all, 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 say somebody got to say it all.
Break, and now we're back, and now we're gonna move into the box office results. And oh boy, I'm gonna let Scott take this one because he is our favorite pundit.
He's a resident expert.
Yeah, but I have to do the results first because last week we of course made our predictions for what we thought Sherlock would do in its opening weekend, and I guess 67. Abe,
I wasn't here.
Oh, you were here last week. So, yeah, Mark Hoban guessed 71, Alan Aguilera guessed 70, and our friend Adam Gentry guessed 35. So, have a little talk with Adam. We'll let that roll, whatever. Abe will figure out a way to edit that conversation in later.
That's like editing right it. Now.
It appears that Sherlock apparently came in at 40 million, which is right around what you guessed. Do you remember what you guessed, sir?
35.
Yep, and that's shockingly very close. And since we
is it shocking that Sherlock performed so poorly, or shocking that I was that close?
That close. We'll get to it. Scott Mendelson is going to go over in detail what happened at the box office this weekend, because it's pretty. There's a lot of interesting activity, so we'll get to that. But we wanted to bring you in just for you to claim your victory, sir. So congratulations.
You know what? I happen to have a miniature American flag right here, and I am planting it in the middle of the keyboard, and I claim this victory for Gentry's everywhere.
Great.
Congratulations.
Good to hear. Yeah.
Thank you, sirs.
Okay. But yeah, so those predictions were wrong, because I'm going to let Scott take it away at this point and go over the box office for this week.
Wow, was my thoughts on Friday evening as the numbers were coming in. There has been talk for a while that somehow the domestic box office is in this big slump, that people aren't going to the movies anymore and Hollywood is doomed. And a lot of it is nonsense. You just have smaller films that aren't opening to blockbuster numbers because they're smaller films. And the whole, this week added a small weekend total, cumulative total, was smaller than last year's same weekend. Again, you know, different movies are going to do different numbers. You know, the first few months of 2011 were kind of down from 2010 because you didn't have overlap from Avatar and then you didn't have Alice in Wonderland or How to Train Your Dragon. But my goodness, these, you know, I was expecting about 75, 80 million from Sherlock 2.
Yeah.
Maybe, obviously, I was wrong. And I try not to blame the movie when I'm wrong. I was expecting, you know, something close to 50 for Alvin and the Chipmunks 3. I certainly wasn't expecting, you know, an opening 6 million higher than Yogi Bear. And I certainly wasn't expecting Sherlock Holmes 2 to open to less than Tron.
Hmm.
Yes, I will say that both films, Sherlock and Alvin and the Chipmunks 3, you know, went without 3D. Which is interesting, because when they were both announced 2 years ago, year and a half ago, they were both going to be 3D releases. Yet, sure enough, this weekend when they came out, neither of these films went out in 3D, which may or may not mean something in terms of how, you know, studios are looking at 3D as sort of a catch-all, you know, ticket price boost. Having said that, Sherlock Holmes 2 did $40 million. The first film opened over Christmas weekend 2 years ago, did $62 million. That was against the second weekend of Avatar, which did $75 million. So you would think Sherlock Holmes 2 and Alvin and the Chipmunks 3 would have at least comparable, if not bigger, opening weekends than the previous installments because they didn't have Avatar to contend with. But as you know, both opening weekends were a lot lower. Is this real evidence that there really is a slump? I don't know. We'll see how well the films do over Christmas weekend. Movies that open the weekend before Christmas have notoriously long legs because you have your three-day weekend that then parlays into about 2 weeks of pure everybody's off of work and everybody's off of vacation time. So basically every day is a weekend day. Every day is Saturday until the end of the year. Mm-hmm. It's possible that it really is the movie stupid, as I like to say. And I'm not the only one that says this. With Sherlock Holmes 2, and ironically, we discussed this the first time I was on this show when we were discussing the first Sherlock Holmes trailer.
Yeah.
In that by casting a character actor as Moriarty, right. You lost a huge, huge chunk of what could have been the marketing campaign for the sequel, which is look at who we got to play Moriarty, and we're going to base the entire marketing campaign around, hey, look, it's Brad Pitt as Professor Moriarty, or it's Daniel Day-Lewis as Professor Moriarty. Because you add Jared Harris as Moriarty, a very good actor who I think did very well with the material he was given, you didn't have you had nothing new to offer. It was just, hey, look, it's Sherlock Holmes again. It's Jude Law and Robert Downey Jr. bantering again, but with lots of gunfire this time. And that's really that was what the marketing campaign was. You know, you might have noticed, you might have not. Almost every piece of print media had Sherlock Holmes and or Watson carrying a gun. And that was really the only new thing, is the promise of more frantic action. And I think this might just be a case where audiences liked the first film a lot. You know, it opened to $62 million, top 200 domestic, and then did $500 million worldwide. But it wasn't something that they automatically wanted to see a sequel to, unless there was a hook. And because you didn't have anyone, any interesting actor, and I don't want to insult Jared Harris, but let's be honest, he's not a movie star. You didn't have that hook that to get people excited about another one. The same thing with the Chipmunks 3, which did $23 million, which is shockingly low considering the first film opened to about $44 million on the same weekend 2 years ago against the $77 million debut of I Am Legend. The second film had, hey, look, we've got the Chipettes. And you had the trailer that basically, hey, look, not only do we have the Chipettes, they're singing Beyoncé's Single Ladies. Isn't that neat? We can argue about whether that's neat or not. I'm on the it's, but for the generic family moviegoer, that was pretty neat. And this film, I guess they get shipwrecked. It seemed to be a much quieter advertising campaign this time around.
They got shipwrecked, to be fair.
Yes, they got shipwrecked, and David Cross is still there. it's a gig. I don't begrudge him. He took some grief for doing the first one, and he basically said, up yours, I'm a working actor. You may not think, unless you're Tom Cruise, you basically have to take every gig that you get. And so that's, in my opinion, why those two films opened lower than, much lower than expected, is that you didn't have a reason to get people into the theater other than it's more of what you saw 2 years ago. And, being optimistic, maybe, just maybe, they were films that I want to see them, but I don't need to see them right now, and I'll see them over the Christmas week. Hmm. The weekday numbers will be very interesting. If Sherlock Holmes 2 is anywhere near where Sherlock Holmes 1 was at the end of the year, even with that extra weekend, then you're not going to panic. But if the film, taps out, and it might, because you've got a gajillion films opening over Christmas and you've got Mission Impossible 2 taking all the press, you might end up with a $120 million in the U.S. and hope to God that it does overseas numbers, and that's been the pattern this year, where you have sequels that slightly or significantly underperform compared to their predecessors, but do monster numbers overseas. Transformers 3, Cars 2, Kung Fu Panda 2, Pirates of the Caribbean 4. None of those films approach the domestic totals of their previous films. All of them pretty much topped the overseas numbers by a healthy margin. But the big story is the IMAX debut of Mission Impossible 4. This was a huge gamble on Paramount's and IMAX's point. You had a 400-screen debut 5 days before the regular opening weekend. I've never seen anything like this before. This is a genuinely new idea, bringing back the idea of if you want to see a movie first, you have to see it on a quality theater. Mm. That was, you know, officially that was Brad Bird's reason why he wanted to do it. He wanted to bring back the idea of, you know, the premiere, the... You know, again, you don't get to see this movie first in a shoebox theater or, you know, a megaplex at the mall with lousy light levels. If you want to see it first, you have to pay a premium, but you're going to get your money's worth in the presentation. It did $32,000 a screen on 425 screens. That's the eighth biggest wide release per screen average in history. Pardon me for using this line again, but mission accomplished. Everybody's talking about how good the movie was. Everybody's talking about how much fun it is. They go into Christmas weekend. I think it's going to dominate Christmas weekend box office. And if it does, if it has a huge opening weekend, or if it takes a certain amount, a loss on opening weekend because of the sneak preview, but does very good business over the long run, this could be a game changer. You could see big movies doing early IMAX releases. You know, I don't think The Dark Knight Rises is going to do it because they want that three-day opening weekend record. And they're not going to get it if they open 5 days early. Mm-hmm. You might see it with The Amazing Spider-Man if Sony thinks they have the goods, where it's supposed to open like on Tuesday,
It's like a July 4th weekend.
Yeah, July 1st, 2nd, whatever. They may go Friday and say, up yours to whatever movie is opening on the 29th. I think Warner Brothers is looking, you know, would probably, again, if they have the goods, if it's a good movie, Superman Man of Steel might do this. Star Trek II, the maybe possibly Wrath of possibly Khan might do this as well. Although, what
about the Avengers, do you think they could do it?
No, they're set.
No, they're set. They want the 3-day record. I don't think they're going to get it, but they want it.
That's that Marvel, like, May, beginning of May weekend. They're together, right. Get there. And it's not 3D or IMAX.
I don't know. I don't know if it's IMAX or not. It damn well should be, frankly, but... Mm-hmm. And I...
See those explosive Scarlett Johansson farts in the background.
Exactly. We can hear five lines of dialogue on a giant IMAX screen. Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit.
The Hobbit, whatever. There you go.
Yeah, because cool. That's a movie that's playing for legs. They're not, you know... the next Twilight movie, unless they think they can get the opening weekend record. But the best part about this, and this is long-term, you know, speculation here, if the movie does well over the long term, fueled by the IMAX platform release, we could finally see the end of the opening weekend is everything mentality that has frankly gripped this industry for 10 years. And that will have a number of positive effects. Frankly, I think you'll start seeing better movies overall. Because if you need more than just the opening weekend, you know, if opening weekend isn't everything, if it's not all about, you know, marketing, get them there in the first 3 days. You don't care if it does 90% of your money in the first 17 days. Then there is an incentive to make a good movie. But I have been rambling nonstop for 5 minutes. Why do you guys think Sherlock 2 underperformed?
I am really curious about that myself. I have no idea. Like, this is not the movie. Of the movies that I thought Mission Impossible would be the movie that kind of, you know, floundered out and around this time, mainly because it doesn't seem like that after, especially after Mission Impossible 3, which was, you know, a lot of people like that movie. I like that movie a lot, but I know studios were, you know, blaming Tom Cruise's antics for that movie not doing as well as the second film. And I was curious as to why they put Mission Impossible down at Christmas time, holiday time, among all these other movies that are all coming out. No one wanted to play chicken, apparently, because you still have all these movies opening at the dead of the year. And it's like, that seemed like the movie that was bound to, you know, not do as well just because of the supposed Tom Cruise's star has faded kind of thing. But that was not the case, apparently, mainly because it's, you know, a fantastic movie and it has some good things to bring to. There's just a lot of good things with that. With Sherlock, I have no idea why. It was a very successful movie a couple years ago. Like, it has Robert Downey Jr., who's still arguably one of the most popular movie stars in the world right now. Like, I don't know why Sherlock did not perform as well as it has. As its why it not didn't open better than its predecessor did. It's confusing to me. But even then, Avatar, how much did Avatar open in its opening?
77.
Weekend? In its opening weekend?
Yes.
Okay.
And that was the giant snowstorm.
Yeah, that it had basically no stars in it, essentially. Yeah. No like giant box office.
Stephen
draws.
Lang.
Yeah, yeah, Stephen Lang. Michelle Rodriguez and Sigourney Weaver. The idea was James Cameron had a 3D movie. That was the big selling point of that one. I don't know why a sequel to a very popular first film would not have done as well. Yeah, I don't know. That's a confusing one to me. I'm very curious to see what legs this movie has, especially with all the movies that are coming out in the coming weeks, of how well it's going to do overall.
If I may offer a brief mea culpa, I thought Paramount was borderline ridiculous for not moving Mission Impossible 4 to the summer.
Yeah.
Once they decided that Star Trek 2 was going to come out in 2028, I was basically saying, you know, dear God, move Mission Impossible 4 to the summer. Oh God, you know, June 29th, summer. And then they did it with G.I. Joe instead. And I even wrote an article saying, good idea, you know, basically, you idiots, what are you thinking? And I was wrong. So it happens. sorry, carry on.
Yeah, Jordan, any thoughts on?
Up here, the push for Sherlock Holmes hasn't been aggressive. Like, I just haven't seen enough of it, and I'm not sure how it is in LA, but that could be a possibility. Was that the marketing just wasn't as aggressive as say Avatar or even the first Sherlock Holmes? I felt they were pushing that more than the sequel.
Yeah, I don't know. The marketing seemed about on. It did seem very, samesies was the kind of the thing that I was feeling about the whole marketing for sure. Like, as basically Scott said, it seemed like basically the same exact movie again in terms of how it was being marketed, which is
right.
How I would say how the first one kind of worked out, just in terms of how that movie managed to be a success along with, the quality of that movie. So, it's a stumper, honestly. Like, it was surprising to see that low of a number for Sherlock Holmes 2. I don't know. Did Iron Man 2 open higher than? Yeah, it did.
Yes, it did. And that's actually what I was thinking as an example. It did 128 million versus 100 million for the first one. So it was like a 29% rise. So I was expecting a 29% rise this time.
Okay.
It also had the same problem of frankly, a crappy villain. Oh boy, it's a shirtless Mickey Rourke with whips. That's scary.
With a terrible accent.
With a ridiculous Russian accent.
But he went on to reprise that role in The Expendables later on in the summer.
Yes. Yes. But still, that movie did, to a token degree, top the original's opening weekend. Mm-hmm. So I figure at least it would do, 29% of 62 would have been a record for December, $79 million. So I wasn't entirely thinking that, but, 65, 70 would have, as I said, I don't want to believe that there is some kind of phantom box office slump running around and people have magically stopped going to the movies. But those two movies opening as low as they did, it's scary.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, a lot of people didn't like the first one, which surprises me because I find it very entertaining. But
yeah,
we can get to our thoughts on the movie. But even then, it still made a ton of money. The first one, no one really liked Transformers 2, but that movie, that movie has its own bank, the bank of Transformers. Speaking of Sherlock so heavily, let's move into our review of Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows.
What do you see?
Everything. That is my curse. Oh, how I've missed you, Holmes.
Have you?
I barely noticed your absence. I'm knee-deep in the single most important case of my career.
What are we up against here?
The most formidable criminal mind in Europe.
Professor James Moriarty.
If we can stop him, we should prevent the collapse of Western civilization. No pressure.
All right, so that was a little bit of the trailer for Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows, the sequel to the first Sherlock Holmes film, which also starred Robert Downey Jr., Jude Law, and was directed by Guy Ritchie. This sequel finds Sherlock deep in a web of trying to capture Professor Moriarty in the act. Basically, Moriarty's the anti-Holmes in a sense. He's every bit as clever as Holmes, but also in the guise of a seemingly good guy, except he's actually an anarchist looking to kind of bring down, well, Western civilization. And so Sherlock eventually gets himself involved in Moriarty's plans and has to figure out a way to stop him with the help of his trusty aide, Watson, who is, well, he's trying to move on himself as he's getting married. He's gotten married now, and, well, he's gonna, I guess, help Sherlock out one last time. And also helping them is a gypsy named Madame Simza, played by Noomi Rapace of the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo Swedish films. Two actors from the same movie in the same episode. But, things progress and get heavy as Sherlock and Watson try to make their way in capturing Moriarty. So, lighthearted sleuthing ensues, I guess. So, Abe, what did you think of Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows?
This was a really fun movie. I really enjoyed it a lot. I thought that it was good as a detective story at its core, and it was kind of really taking the viewer along for the ride. The way that they were filming some of the scenes, like the forest action scenes, that was fantastic. I really enjoyed that a lot. You know, with like the slow-mo and then also like the high speed, and it's just pretty cool stuff. I thought the acting was really cool. Really good stuff from even Stephen Fry being very, you know, strange as Mycroft Holmes. And then I thought about it. I was like, wow, you know, I think Stephen Fry would have made a good Moriarty, except he doesn't really have that much, you know, he doesn't really give off that vile, you know, sense of whenever you see him on the screen. But
I have a new question for you now. Philip Seymour Hoffman naked or Stephen Fry naked?
Wait, which one is more disturbing?
does it matter how I context that question?
I think I could stomach Stephen Fry more because his accent kind of just is like, okay, yeah, all right. And you know, he's a little bit more free with himself, I'm sure. Philip Seymour Hoffman, yeah, that's pretty disturbing. And I think that the film was smart. It wasn't overly smart. It wasn't trying to like make the viewer think too hard, but it was clever in a way, which is almost my retroview of Ocean's 11 and some of the BBC Sherlock. I really enjoyed this movie, actually. I didn't think that I was going to. I mean, I saw the Rotten Tomatoes score, and I was like, well, maybe it's, you know, average at best. But I was like, yeah, this is actually a pretty fun, entertaining movie. I think one of the only drawbacks is the tad long. I really didn't like the length that much. But other than that, I mean, everything was pretty cool.
Yeah, I quite liked it. A bit, I think. More than the first one. But kind of like the first one, like Abe said, like, there were some lulls in the pacing. But overall, you know, I found it to be hilarious. I laughed more than I have in most comedies that have been released this year. I thought Stephen Fry was great in it. However, I wish there would have been more of Moriarty. I felt like we didn't get to see enough of him, and we were kind of just thrown in there with no real introduction to what's been going on. It's kind of like, oh, this is the end of his story, and I wanted more of the development of who he was. But having said that, I thought that what's his name that played Moriarty? It's
Jared Harris.
Yeah, I thought he did a fine job with the character, and I've heard some people complain that his presence wasn't strong enough, and I disagree. I thought he did just fine. He was menacing, and the end with them playing chess was thrilling, I thought. I wasn't big on the whole gypsy subplot. I felt that kind of went along for too long. As well as them riding on the donkeys, that one scene, that Lord of the Ring-esque shot that seemed to go on for half the movie at one point. But I enjoyed it. Cool. Thumbs up.
Cool. Scott?
I enjoyed the picture overall. I liked the first one a little bit more. I thought it was a slightly more – the first one was a slightly more disciplined picture. I sort of missed the first film's melancholy. There was a certain character-driven sadness to Watson and Holmes' relationship the first time around. This was a bit more, hey, they're just two goofy pals who like to bother each other. It's like the Odd Couple with detective, with mysteries. Ironically, the thing that I liked most about the first film, their relationship, was the thing that I found most tedious this time around. Mainly because, they're squabbling, and all I'm thinking is, I just want to get back to Moriarty. I mean, the film's about 120 minutes without credits. And there's about 40 minutes of this film that are just dynamite. The prologue, which is about 10 minutes long, is phenomenal. Which introduces Moriarty. And yeah, he's not a particularly imposing character, but without going into details, he kills several people right off the bat.
Yeah.
And so that's nice. That's how you establish that he's a bad guy. You have him killing people. And then there's a scene about right at the end of the first act where Sherlock Holmes goes to meet Moriarty and they have a conversation, which I won't reveal the details of per se. And that's a wonderful scene that establishes that he is menacing not because of how he acts, but simply because of what he does. And he doesn't have to act menacing because he is menacing. You know, if you're willing to kill innocent people and blow stuff up and whatever, you don't have to prance around. You don't always have to, laugh maniacally while you're doing it. And there's a decent, basically any scene where Moriarty was in was phenomenal. But and you guys mentioned this, there wasn't enough of him. And this is another place where I feel the film faltered by not casting a bigger star as Moriarty. Because you had a character actor, there wasn't the pressure to give him time in the spotlight. One thing I did think was kind of interesting is you really only saw Moriarty when the character saw Moriarty. And this was actually kind of similar, I might be mistaken here, but to my knowledge, you only saw Moriarty when certain other characters are running into him. Mm-hmm. And that was actually similar to, Heath Ledger as the Joker. You never saw the Joker in his hideout planning his evil plots. You only saw him when everybody else saw him. But the rest of the film, frankly, the middle, I found kind of tedious. I didn't care about the action sequences, though a few of them were relatively impressive. I liked the fight scene in the first act where Sherlock Holmes chains a bad guy and uses a chain as a weapon. It's hard to explain, but it works very well. Mm-hmm. I thought Noomi Rapace, is that how you pronounce her name?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe so, yes.
I thought she was as boring as unbuttered toast. Mm-hmm. I think this film, and arguably the first film as well, is a paramount example of the problem that I have with, there's got to be a girl. Yes, I don't particularly want to see films that are pure sausage fests. And I, the world is 50% women. We shouldn't see six dudes and a hot chick. But if there's no place for her to be integral to the story, yes, I would rather have just seen a picture of, Watson and Holmes running around trying to stop Moriarty. She had no real purpose to be in the film. She was not a love interest, thank God. But, she didn't really provide any interesting information. She was just there because there's got to be a pretty girl tagging along to put on the poster, to put in the trailer. Ironically, and this is the very opening scene in the movie, but Rachel McAdams does have a few scenes in this film. It's basically an extended cameo, but she does show up enough to make an impression. And she is far more interesting in her extended cameo than she was the entirety of the first film.
I completely agree with that.
Yeah.
And in my opinion, the reason for that is because she's not being constrained by being the quasi-love interest. Basically, she was there in the first film. No. Sherlock Holmes and Watson aren't gay because there's a girl there. As opposed to Sherlock Holmes and Watson aren't gay because Watson's marrying a woman. But that's another thing. And I've written about this before. It always drives me nuts where anytime there's a friendship between two men, everybody starts talking about how gay they are. And frankly, that's an insidious form of homophobia. But getting off that for a moment, because she was not the love interest this time around, she was free to be the villainess, basically. She is an active participant. And, does bad things. And when she and Holmes do meet up for a moment or two, I don't want to go into details on how they meet up because it's kind of a spoiler, but they basically are flirtatious enemies. and it was far more fun seeing them be flirtatious enemies than the first film where, you know, she's kind of a villainess, but she's really an okay girl, and it's okay for Holmes to have feelings for her, because she's really not that bad. And so I want to wrap this up because I've been rambling for too long. I loved all the stuff with Moriarty. I found the rest of the movie comparatively tedious, so as a result, I did not like it quite as much as the first film, but I would still recommend seeing it.
All right. I would say I put it on par with the first film in a couple of ways. Some things it does better than the first, some things it does, you know, lesser. I do think it's a little long. Which is a similar problem that the first one had, where it kind of carries on. It could have been tightened up more, could have dropped some things. Mainly, yes, the gypsy plot involving Noomi Rapace, who, much like Jared Harris, is like, that's not the traditional choice that you'd make for, you know, the lead actress in your, you know, your big franchise picture, which might have also contributed to why it wasn't, you know, star power does mean something, I think, and I think that might have had an effect, but it was an interesting choice to see her be chosen as the, you know, the lead actress in this film. But with that said, she doesn't get much to do. She gets to basically arrive with Sherlock and Watson at a scene and then wait outside while the boys go and play. That's kind of her role in this film after an opening action sequence with her, which was quite enjoyable. Yeah, she doesn't really get much to do here in this film. And you could have kind of dropped that character. You would have tightened up the film right there, and I would have liked it even more, probably. But with that said, getting back to the good things, I liked a lot of this movie quite a bit. I like the action a lot in this movie. There's a lot of stakes, I think. I think a problem with some action, certain characters that are, you know they're not going to die, that kind of affects a movie sometimes. But I think with Sherlock Holmes, these guys get beat up quite a bit in this movie. Like, these guys, you see them going, getting rough and tumble. You see them taking shot. You see them bloodied and black-eyed and dying at points. Like, these guys are, they're taking some hits along with being just detectives, and I kind of admired that. I admired the sequence that, like, is all in all the trailers is the big slow-mo chase sequence through the woods, which I thought was very much Guy Ritchie having a lot of fun. I admired seeing his visual style at work in scenes like that, in other scenes throughout the film as well. I like the there's a really cool Jude Law moment where I was thinking this is just like Enemy at the Gates, that I really admired, because he's got there's some sniping action going on. I was like, this made me think back to that. That was kind of cool. I absolutely love Jared Harris in the Moriarty role, especially in his confrontation scenes with Holmes. The way those are played, the way the rivalry is established, and how they interact with one another, especially in the final payoff and how that plays out. I thought that all that stuff was really well handled. I do wish there was more Moriarty and, once again, less gypsy stuff, and that would have made it happen. But overall, I like the way he was handled in this film. I like the way he matched his knowledge with Holmes in more ways than just talking about it and seeing it exhibited in action. I thought that was really cool. And yeah, as far as Downey and Law go, I like Jude Law a lot as Watson. I thought that was really ingenious casting for the first film. And I liked him once again here. And Robert Downey Jr., he just seems to be having a blast as the Sherlock Holmes character. But even with that said, there's not as much... Well, Scott put it best. There's melancholy in the first film, and yeah, it's more lighthearted, I guess I would say, overall than the first film. But there were some Sherlock beats in here where it was like there's kind of some drama in the situation that I kind of saw. I liked where they didn't really need to expand the character, but I kind of saw he had motivations that were somewhat personal that I kind of appreciated, which came across to me anyway. But yeah, overall, yeah, I really did enjoy this movie a lot, and I've been saying all along, if you really liked the first movie, you'd probably really like this movie. If you thought the first one was okay, you might like this one more. I know a lot of people that just thought it was the first one was okay and really came away liking this one more. And if you didn't like, if you don't like this, the first movie, you're not gonna like this one, because it's not your father's Sherlock. I really hate that expression, but it seems to keep catching on so many times. It's very much a Hollywoodized Sherlock, but I don't think that's a bad thing. I think there's a level of charm and wit to the plot beyond just being a brainless action film that makes these Sherlock films work for me, and that's what's been keeping me involved in these films so far. The likability of the cast and kind of the charming, witty nature of the screenplay, even though it's not intensely smart. It's not the first Mission Impossible, but it's a good fit. Jordan, to call you out, I know you like scores quite a bit. What did you think of Hans Zimmer's score in this film?
It was basically more of the same from the first one, I thought. There are a few nice touches I enjoyed, but overall, you know, more of the same. The first one was much more surprising.
I agree with that.
I enjoy listening to it. I have it on my iPhone, so.
That was one thing about the first one that took me off guard, is just how creative the score seemed to be from Hans Zimmer. So yeah, I was looking forward to hearing this one. Yeah, it is a lot of the same, but it's like I like this style for this. I like the Sherlock theme, so that was cool.
Oh yeah, it's wonderful. I also thought in the film the his little theoretical fights were used to better effect.
Yeah, the Holmes vision.
Yeah.
To piggyback on what Jordan had said earlier about this later Holmes vision scene, that was really well played. I liked the way that they matched intellect at that scene. I kind of wasn't expecting it, and I was rather entertained by it, actually.
I agree. I liked the quote-unquote Holmes vision. And I got to tell you, just offhand, when the film was reaching its climax, and I know some of you hinted about what happens, but I don't want to. Mm-hmm. When I realized that, oh, this film is not going to end with an action scene, I almost wanted to leap up and applaud. I was generally, you know, concerned that the movie would not end with basically a duel of sorts. You know, basically it would end with an action scene with, hey, look, more gunfire and chasing. And the last 20 minutes of this movie are fantastic. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mostly.
I agree. You say mostly. I think you. Well, I think there's. You're referring to maybe a cop out on the ending.
Yes, which I'm barely even going to hint at.
Right.
But they had a chance to end in a very brave way that I think audiences would have been okay with.
Yeah.
And they didn't. And now that I've said that, anyone that sees the movie is going to pretty much know what I'm talking about. Although, you know, if you, and something someone else mentioned about wanting to see the, you know, the progression of the Moriarty story from the beginning, to be fair, that was actually faithful to the original novel. In the one story, one of really two stories.
He's not in many stories, Moriarty, in the original.
He's only in two stories. And the first one, which this movie was adapted from, The Final Problem, it starts as after Holmes has been chasing Moriarty for like 4 or 5 years. And it really is the end of their battle. Without going into details, and, you know, the second I saw Watson typing up the story on the typewriter, like, oh, okay, this is going to end like The Final Problem ended. Cool. And it did, but then it didn't.
Yeah.
And even if they wanted to suggest that there was going to be a sequel, there were more subtle ways to do it than simply stating, okay, relax, no big deal. And I know I'm being stupidly vague here, but
no, I know what you mean. And I think they could have, it probably would have been cool with just the post.
Just a certain reveal and not a second one.
Yes.
And I'll say this, I did like it. It kind of rang to the, not necessarily like the Hollywood need this in me, but more of the just, this whole movie was a lot of fun, and I was happy with the fun nature of how it all came together at the end. Okay, here's the point. There are a lot of with Sherlock Holmes. The whole thing is that he manages to predict all these situations ahead of time, you know, using his Holmes vision essentially. And I think there are a lot of things that were set up in this movie that were supposed to come back later on that were kind of kind of surprising, I guess, in the way they were called back to and used. And I think I was able to call a lot of those things before they happened, as opposed to the first film, kind of, where I think there was a little more of me not seeing it coming necessarily, kind of thing. Did anyone else kind of?
I did catch one massive clue that I'm debating if I should reveal or not. I did catch one massive clue that ended up being a big part of the mystery at the end of the film. You know, that was revealed. It's very important at the end of the film, and I certainly didn't catch anything of that nature in the first time around.
Yeah, that's.
And I'm debating if I should say what it is. Nah, doesn't matter.
Okay. Yeah, there are just like a few things where I'm like, I can see where this will play into later in the film, right. even as briefly as they kind of touched upon what that thing was. So.
Well, one thing I did like, I remember what I was going to say, is, and I'm going to be vague because I'm talking about the climax, is I love the fact that to a certain extent, Holmes basically trusts his friends to help him. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it'd been developed better. It could have been the culmination of an arc, but where he kind of sees Watson as an equal at long last.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't well developed, but I like the payoff anyway.
Mm-hmm.
How about
Mrs. Watson? How about Kelly Riley in this film? Because she has one really cool moment that I kind of admire.
Yes, she does.
Quite a bit. She got to do more in this film, which I kind of admire.
I wish if they were going to have a girl to tag along, just bring her along.
Yeah.
That's what I thought halfway through, actually. Yeah.
And speaking of that scene, actually, that whole train sequence, I actually liked quite. Again, I like the action scenes in this movie, and I like that train bit a lot. Actually, I had a lot of fun, regardless of Robert Downey Jr.'s ridiculous use of disguises.
No, I enjoyed that one because it made sense in terms of the story. There was a reason for everybody to be on the train. And there was something at stake.
Yeah, it had the right amount of dramatic tension as well as the right amount of lightheartedness that I kind of admired in Holmes' approach to assist us, him approaching what helping the Watsons, I guess.
Yes. It was a little, you know, it went on a little while, but it was good action. It wasn't, you know, Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol good, but it was a quality action sequence. And I would argue to a certain extent, the action in this film is pretty good. It's just, it's hard for me to appreciate it because I felt so much of it was gratuitous.
Yeah, I would agree with that statement because it certainly goes kind of a blockbuster bombastic route for the sequel of making things bigger and not necessarily needing it to be at the scale it was. But with that said, again, I did like the action quite a bit here. I liked the way Guy Ritchie's acquitted himself to this kind of movie. I think a lot of people were kind of writing Guy Ritchie off after he, you know, made Lock, Stock, and Snatch, and then kind of moved on to, well, he moved on to Madonna, and things went downhill very quickly. And then he made Rock and Rolla, which I liked. I like Rock and Rolla a lot. Actually, I watched it again just recently, but it's kind of like, is this guy just a one-trick pony? But then you finally see him kind of flex his muscles with, you know, just a genre movie, basically. Like, that's what I've been. I personally was like, why does he just like make like an X-Men movie or something like that, where he can just really get his hands dirty with something that he can just play with visually and not have to worry about writing something? And I think he's acquitted himself quite well with the Sherlock Holmes franchise, where he gets to kind of apply his eye to it and, you know, make it a visually exciting movie, make things. It has a really neat energy to it, which is something that you don't. Seems almost oxymoronical with Sherlock Holmes of having him, you know, be a, you know, a fighter and the action scenes going on in the midst of this, you know, sleuthing detective kind of stuff. So I like how this film came together overall, even with the problems that we've mentioned. And I'd like to see where Guy Ritchie goes from here, with even if there's not another sequel, but with, you know, other films that he doesn't need to necessarily write, but just kind of apply his visual stamp to. I know Eddie Marzan, who's a character actor, he was in the first one quite a bit as Inspector Lestrade. Was he in this movie much? Like, he had one scene towards the end.
Yes. And he gets really high billing, so I'm thinking there was deleted scenes.
That's what I'm thinking, too, because, like...
Yeah, third billing or fourth billing, something like
that. Yeah, something like that.
Because I did not see him in this movie until, like, the very end. So it's like, what?
Yeah, in a situation with, you know, high billing like that, either there's deleted scenes or he's the killer.
So I hope there must be the lead scenes, I guess, and especially because there's a lot going on in this plot. So that was actually another problem I had. There was the movie took its time to getting to what the actual plot was. That's something I noticed. Like, beyond just knowing that Sherlock Holmes was on the trail of Moriarty, there was no real plot in this movie up until kind of like midway through it seemed, where there was like finally a clear path of what needed to be done.
Well, it's toward the end of the second act when the plan is revealed. I kind of liked it because, again, you know, this isn't really spoilerish, but it's the same plot that I mentioned about a half an hour ago that Blofeld's been doing since the 60s.
Yeah.
And it's funny, you have two big action films where the villain's plot is basically the same thing for different reasons. Moriarty goes more the neocon route. You know, I want to do bad things so I can profit from it. But again, you know, it's same plot, very funny.
Okay. Any other thoughts on Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows before we kind of give our review or rating.
Still worth seeing. There are good things in it. It's still very literate, very intelligent. The acting is very good. See it at your leisure, which apparently is what America did this weekend.
All right. Well, yeah, so the rating scale, we have IMAX Theater, Dollar Theater, Netflix, HBO, TV, forget about it. Where'd you settle that one in?
Theater, but matinee.
Yeah, all right. Jordan?
Yeah, theater.
Abe?
High theater, yeah, I really liked it.
Yeah, theater as well for me. I have a lot of fun with these Sherlock Holmes movies, and I hope they do. I hope this one has legs, because I would like to see a third one. I'd like to see more Adventures of Holmes, preferably not in 3D.
Well, and, as long as Stephen Fry gets naked, they've got my $10.
There you go. Mycroft's Lycroft. That doesn't make any sense, but I'll go with it. Jesus, that was terrible. Let's move on to our retro review, where we, you know, have a few movies that we thought of. Any movies come to mind, Abe?
Just Ocean's 11, just in terms of, you kind of know what's going on, but after they reveal the things, it makes it a little bit cooler, too.
Scott?
Obviously, the first Sherlock Holmes movie. Again, the James Bond films that I felt that the film's plot was emulating. So, you know, You Only Live Twice, Tomorrow Never Dies, Moonraker, Spy Who Loved Me. Let's see. And, you know, Iron Man 2, and the fact that I felt, you know, they didn't have a villain by virtue, in this case, in virtue of screen time, that was really all that compelling. In this case, when he was on screen, he was great. With Iron Man 2, both villains were kind of lame.
This movie also had action, which Iron Man 2 didn't.
Iron Man 2 was an action film?
So it was a screwball comedy, I think.
I thought it was a remake of Batman Forever with no action.
Jordan?
just the first Sherlock Holmes, really. Nothing exciting.
I thought of Mummy Returns, and mainly because The Mummy Returns, which is a movie I don't hate, actually. I kind of enjoy that movie. But compared to the first Mummy, it's the exact same movie, except you've added an annoying child. That's The Mummy Returns. It follows all the same plot beats. And that's kind of what I was worried about with Sherlock Holmes, too, where it would just go the bigger version of the first movie, where it rehashes everything about the first one, but just does it bigger. But it didn't, actually. I thought it did a good job of separating itself and making itself seem like an additional entry into the Sherlock Holmes film franchise, opposed to just a new coat of paint over the first Sherlock Holmes movie.
One of the things I liked about The Mummy Returns, actually, is that I liked some of the new characters. It is a very hectic movie. It's not as good as the first one.
Yeah.
But I liked the increased role, for example, for what's his name? Odette Fair? Yes. Yeah. Get fair, and him getting his own arch villain, played by AAA. I'm not gonna try that one.
Mr. Echo from Lost, yeah.
And I kind of like the relationship. I like the relationship that he had with the kid. Therefore, the kid didn't bother me. That he was the character that shared our annoyance with this obnoxious child.
I can agree with
and
that.
Yeah. I can forgive a movie certain things when the movie acknowledges what it's acknowledges that it's doing it, and mocks it openly.
Okay, so let's move on to what we're going to talk about next week, and that is going to be the heartwarming family double feature of The Adventures of Tintin and The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Those are no laughs for that one, huh?
I was laughing on the inside. I knew it was coming.
I was waiting for like a huge punchline. Okay.
Leave all that in. that's. Yeah, so next week we're going to talk about The Adventures of Tintin and The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, hopefully in the same show. There might even be a very special guest in my eyes for one of those reviews, but we'll see. And yeah, that's just among the many, many releases that come out next week. So I honestly have no way to predict or to ask how we should predict the box up. So let me just list some of these. What's coming out next week? We got Tintin, Dragon Tattoo, War Horse, The Darkest Hour.
Darkest Hour is going to be number one.
Darkest Hour in 3D.
It's opening on Sunday, but in one day, it'll outgross everything it opens on Wednesday and Friday.
We bought a zoo. Let's see. There's expansion of movies like The Artist, My Week with Marilyn, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, Extremely Loud, Incredibly Close comes out in a few theaters. War Horse comes out. So many movies come out next week. It's absolutely ridiculous. The wide release of Mission Impossible 4. I guess I don't even want to predict anything. Maybe... No, I don't even want to predict anything.
I'm about to cry.
What would come in first, I guess, would be my guess. What would come in first?
I'm gonna go with the Tintin family. It's gonna be Christmas. A lot of play, but I think that I'm gonna say Tintin.
I'm gonna go with Mission Impossible 4.
I would too.
Because it's the one movie.
Ooh, forgot that it's wide release next week.
Other than Sherlock Holmes 2, perhaps, if you got a big group of a big family of various genders and various age ranges, that's the one movie that arguably they all can agree on. Mm. It's not a cartoon. It's not an insanely violent R-rated thriller. It's not an insanely cheap-looking PG-13 rated thriller. It's not a PG-rated family picture. It's not a 9/11 drama. It's not a very long drama about World War I, although all these films have their, marquee value. If you get 10 family members in a room, they can all agree on Mission Impossible 4.
Yeah, that seems feasible to me. I'm really curious how Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is going to do, since it's basically advertised itself as the anti-Christmas movie. Curious how that's going to fare come this time next week with all these other movies opening, despite it being, based on one of the most popular book franchises currently around the globe. And, it's a new Daniel Craig, not even stars, really, but, David Fincher's name on the tip. Yeah. Hmm.
Well, the original film did do $10 million in the U.S. So.
That's 10 million McNuggets.
No, I think it'll be a strong number too. The only thing that might be concerning for that one is it's about 6.5 hours long, and it's 2.5 hours long, which I'm not the biggest fan of the original. I'm seeing this one on Tuesday, and my first thought when the remake is okay, at least now they can trim the fat, but no, because apparently, like the Twilight sequels, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is the Bible, and The Darkest Hour will make $10. I mean, I have no idea what the heck they were thinking.
It will be my $10.
Hey, if you want to review it for me, send it my way. I'm not going
to
have time.
This is a movie that my mom and I would love to go see, so we probably will check it out. I remember we saw Black Christmas when that opened on Christmas Day.
Oh, so did I.
If it wasn't for the whole white, two kids thing, my wife and I probably would be seeing The Darkest Hour on opening day, because that's the kind of garbage she likes.
But honestly, why did that movie not come out like last week or the week?
December 2nd with nothing else?
Yeah, nothing opened that weekend. Like, we had to scramble to find a show to do that weekend.
What did you guys talk about that week, by the way?
We talked about The Descendants, and we went over like awards.
Oh, okay.
It was actually a good show with Mark.
I do watch most of the shows, for the record.
With Mark. Thanks. It was a good show with Mark Johnson.
That's deep.
We talked a lot about the awards contenders that were, upcoming for the year. So that was a good discussion. I really enjoyed that. But we had nothing to go on because nothing opened that weekend. And it's like, why is The Darkest Hour not opening then? It's not going to make money wherever it opens. Why not just open it when nothing else is there?
And the thing, even last weekend, if MI4 had opened in IMAX last weekend, it would have topped the box office.
Oh my God, yeah.
Because it basically made more than New Year's Eve did last weekend, and you wouldn't have had Sherlock Holmes making $40 million on your butt.
Okay, so that will do it this week for Out Now with Aaron and Abe. You can find more of my work at my personal blog, thecodeofzeke.com, where you can find all my written reviews, as well as at whysoblue.com, where you can find my Blu-ray reviews. You can also, actually, all of us are having our top 10 lists coming out over the course of these next couple weeks, so, feel free to check out Why So Blue to find me and the gang, Brian, Gerard, Sean, all those guys. We're all having our top 10s coming out, so, check those out if you want to. They're kind of fun to do. And you can also find me at twitter.com/AaronsPS3. Abe?
You can find more of my work at walrusmoose.blogspot.com, two animals, walrusmoose.blogspot.com, and twitter.com/walrusmoose.
Jordan?
Oh, the damn dirty blog at blogspot.com and Facebook and Twitter.
You're around.
I'm somewhere.
Scott?
Obviously, Facebook, Twitter, etc. If you want to pretend that I'm important, you can read my stuff at Huffington Post a couple times a week. But if you just want to read the stuff I'm writing, just go to Mendelsohn's Memos.
Awesome. And let's see. Music for this episode will be provided by the Sherlock Holmes and Mission Impossible soundtracks. Make sure to check out our other shows at iTunes. You can find all our episodes there, as well as on the HHWLOD podcast network. We can find our show and the other shows like The Walking Dead TV podcast, Legion of Dudes, Half Hour Wasted. They're all fun shows about comics and games and movies and stuff, just like our opening of our very show states. You can also find most of the new episodes and a few exclusives at outnow.podomatic.com. You can feel free to email us at outnowpodcast@gmail.com. And remember to tell Abe to always go to the bathroom before we start the show and, compliment our guests and how great of a job that they're doing. You can also like our page at facebook.com/outnowpodcast. We tend to update quite a bit and provide, you know, we've had two really cool contests so far that were incredibly easy to enter, and people will win prizes. And those people who are listening, I am sending those out soon, so you will get your prizes. And yeah, good stuff all around. As I've said, this is the end of the show. So thanks again, Scott and Jordan, for coming on today. This was a lot of fun.
You're very welcome. It's always a pleasure.
Quite epic.
It was.
Oh my God.
And you know, happy to have you guys on again. I know we're gonna be trying to do some kind of special end of the year best of list, so I don't even know if we'll record maybe in pieces or something just to get something together, but you know, happy to get your guys' input on, you know, best movies of the year kind of thing, so you know, work that out at some point. But yeah, that's gonna do it this week. So yeah, for that, bye.
Adios amigos.
Farewell.
And then Jordan says something.
Goodbye.